Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Truma. This week, Dr. Mish Hammer-Kassoy discusses Truma. Dr. Mish Hammer-Kassoy is a member of the Pardes faculty. She serves as the director of the social justice track at Pardes and also as the director of admissions for Pardes. And now, Dr. Mish Hammer-Kassoy.
Thank you, Larry. Next Sunday is the 9th of Adar, which is the Jewish Day of Constructive Conflict. My colleague Daniel Roth has been doing some amazing work in pushing us to think about the ways we interface with disagreement in a Jewish way. So today I'd like to model machloket, disagreement, in his honor and salute him and invite you guys to check out the website about how you can get involved, 9adar.org. This week's parsha is called Truma. It's about the Mishkan, the tabernacle. Va'asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham. God commands us to make for him a mikdash, a temple, v'shachanti b'tocham, so that God will dwell amongst us. And the whole parsha builds a lot of details around how that mikdash should look, that tabernacle should look. I'm going to focus this week on just a single object in the Mishkan, the Kruvim, which are described in chapter 25 in just five verses, which I will read with you now. The Kruvim, which are generally translated as cherubs, and we'll try to figure out what those are reading these five verses. Chapter 25, verse 18. Va'asita shnaim kruvim zahav miksha ta'aseh otam mishne k'tzota kaporet. Va'aseh kruv echad miktsa mizeh u'kruv echad miktsa mizeh min ha'kaporet ta'asu et ha'kruvim al shne k'tzotav. You shall make two cherubim of gold, make them of hammered work, at the two ends of the cover. Make one cherub at one end and the other cherub at the other end. Of one piece with the cover shall you make the cherubim at its two ends. So without defining what a cherub is, what a kruv is, we know that they're made of gold. We know that they are two separate things that are made of one hammered piece of gold, which is part and parcel of the cover of the Aron, of the Ark. And I continue. V'haya ha'kruvim porsei k'nafayim l'mala sochachim b'chanfeihem al kaporet ufneihem ish el achiv el ha'kaporet yu pnei ha'kruvim. The cherubim shall have their wings spread out above, shielding the cover with their wings. They shall confront each other, the faces of the cherubim being turned toward the cover. So we see again that the kruvim have wings and that they have faces, and those faces are turned towards each other and towards the cover of the ark. V'natata t'kaporet al ha'aron milamala ve'el Ha'aron titena ta'idut asher itena lecha. V'no'adati lecha sham v'dibarti itcha me'al kaporet mi'ben shnei akruvim asher al aron ha'idut v'et kol asher etzavel otcha el b'nei Yisrael. Place the cover on top of the ark, and after depositing inside the ark the pact that I will give you. And there I will meet with you, and I will impart to you from above the cover between the two Kruvim that are on top of the Ark of the Pact, all that I will command you concerning the Israelite people. So we know that the space between the Kruvim above on top of the Aron is a place of intimacy, a place of speech where Hashem speaks to Moshe Rabbeinu, whatever he says that is the meeting place between Moshe and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So what we know from these verses are a few major things. One, miksha, that they are part of a beaten piece of gold, one unit, that there are two of them, they're connected to each other, that they have faces and wings. However, we don't know what they are. And it's interesting that the Torah seems to assume, perhaps, that we take that we will understand the word kruv without further definition of what a kruv is. And it's really not so clear. So for lack of a better place, and kind of an ironic start, I decided to start with the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, where it says, a type of angel that is usually shown in art as a beautiful young child with small wings and a round face and body. And what I want to do, even though I know, I'm quite sure that Moshe Rabbeinu himself did not have a dictionary. There seems to be an assumption that he did know what a kruv was. I'd like to try to understand where that dictionary definition came from, to try to define what kruvim are and also what they symbolize. That is our mission for the next short while. so in order to understand the Merriam-Webster, I'd like to start with the Rambam. I think the Rambam helps us understand that. In his Guide for the Perplexed, in the third section, chapter 45, he says as follows, the belief in the existence of angels is connected with the belief in the existence of God, and the belief in God and angels leads to the belief in prophecy and truth of the law. In order to firmly establish this creed, God commanded the Israelites to make over the ark the form of two angels. So right from the beginning, we understand how the Rambam understood kruvim as to be angels. And the belief in the existence of angels is thus inculcated into the minds of the people. And this belief is in importance next to the belief in God's existence. It leads us to believe in prophecy and in the law and opposes idolatry. Okay, so the goal of putting these kruvim in the Mishkan or in the Middash, is to help us believe in the angels, to believe in the power of these angels as a way of helping us ultimately to believe in prophecy and Torah, and to deny idolatry and believe in God. And if there had only been one figure of a kruv, the people would have been misled and would have mistaken it for God's image, which was to be worshipped in the fashion of the heathen. Or they might have assumed that the angel represented by a figure was also a deity and would thus have adopted a dualism. By making two kruvim and distinctly declaring, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one, Moshe clearly proclaimed the theory of the existence of a number of angels. There's lots of angels, but there's one Hashem. He left no room for error of considering those figures as deities, since he declared that Hashem Echad, God is one. And he is the creator of the angels who are more than one. Okay, so the point, according to the Rambam, the kruvim are located in the Mishkan to help us because they represent angels, and angels represent for us a sort of intermediary, an in-between point that facilitates prophecy and the belief of God. Earlier he explained that even Moshe received prophecy a number of times through angels. So kruvim, we understand the first part of Merriam-Webster Dictionary to understand kruvim as angels. Where does the Rambam get that idea? It seems to be rooted, perhaps, in two occurrences. There's actually only two occurrences in the Tanakh where the word kruv occurs as representing, I'll say, something that's not a statue, but something, how to say, real or a vision. So in Genesis chapter 3, 24, after Adam and Chava are exiled from the Garden of Eden, God banished them from the Garden of Eden to till the soil from which it was taken. Ve'yigaresha ta'adam v'yashken mikedem legan Eden et ha'kruvim ve'et lahat ha'cherv ha'mitapechet lishmor et derech etzachayim. He drove the man out and stationed east of the Garden of Eden the cherubim and the fiery ever-turning sword to guard the way to the Tree of Life. So that's the first occurrence of the kruvim in the Torah. It's not exactly a beautiful childlike creature, quite the opposite. It's something fiercer, holding a fiery, ever-turning sword, which is preventing Adam from accessing Eden. And that is our first clue as to what the kruv is. Our second clue about the kruvim comes from Yechezkel. Sefer Yechezkel there, Yechezkel has a vision. It's not exactly a real thing, but a vision of winged angelic creatures, which are also fiery and terrifying. He has this vision both in chapter 1 and in chapter 10. In chapter 10, they're named as Kruvim. Even though it's a longer vision, it's actually very, very mysterious and difficult to understand. It's so difficult to understand, in fact, that the rabbis called it Ma'ase Merkava, God's chariot. That's what's described there. And the rabbis identified this passage, and its study as the ultimate in esoteric. So esoteric and dangerous in understanding, it was really considered a vision of God, God's self, that the rabbis restricted discussion of that encounter to not just any one-on-one session, but to an exceptional student who himself can understand things independently. You can teach one student one-on-one about Ma'aseh Merkava, about God's chariot. So I don't think that's something we should get too into in a podcast, it certainly would be appropriate to give a simple reading of what that text is. Yechezkel's vision is a vision of four-faced, four-winged, many-eyed, wheeled creatures. Again, they're carrying fire, and the wings seem to be literally enthroning and carrying God. Literally forming the Kruvim themselves seem to be God, making up God's chariot. They don't have the word legs isn't used in the place of what we would consider legs. There are wheels, and the wheels move the Kruvim, and the Kruvim are many winged figures which themselves carry God in the wings. Flap back and forth in a very strong way, making a great noise and perhaps creating a very confusing, obscuring vision. The wings surround God in a way that make him somewhat difficult to see. And this vision, I think, is pretty easily transferable to our Mishkan. Even though we can also understand the relevance of the Kruvim in Gan Eden as well. If I would sort of try to imagine what is this God's chariot of wings, that the gold of our Mishkan, the statues in our Mishkan, seem to represent the fiery grandness and unapproachability of the living Kruvim. And the wings, in my mind, seem to reflect the transcendence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, his enthronedness, his majesty, and also to obscure him, right? They prevent access because the wings are in the way, almost like multiple bodyguards surrounding HaKadosh Baruch Hu, preventing anyone from getting too close to God, in the same way that the Kruv with the Cherev HaMitzapachat at the gate to Gan Eden is also preventing access. So, in our Parsha, they also are Sochsachin al Bechanfehem al Akaporet. They are covering with their wings the Kaporet. Okay, they are shielding from access, from anybody getting into the covering of the Aron or getting close to what would seem to be the seat of God. They cover and they hide. And this is so much the case that in the Gemara in Yoma, Rabbanai Amar Shmuel, that the Kruvim Benes Hayu Omdim, that it was the Kruvim, one of the miracles in Shlomo's temple was that the Aron and the Kruvim don't seem to actually be contained in the space of the Mishkan. The Mishkan seems to not quite be big enough for the Kruvim themselves and the wings. The wings filled every centimeter of the Kodesh, which in my mind makes seeing or approaching anything that's within that space, absolutely impossible. So to summarize what I think we've learned from the Rambam, from Bereshit, and from Yechezkel, is that the Kruvim are fiery winged angels who mediate between us and a Kadosh Baruch Hu and the divine. They represent mystery, distance, transcendence, an unapproachability of God, God's self, even as they represent God, God's presence in some way. That presence is inaccessible to us. We are, it is a mediated experience. So God commands us to make a mishkan so that he can dwell amongst us on the one hand, but the kruvim represent a distance and an inapproachability that always are essential to the encounter with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's one approach. But in honor of the 9th of Adar and Jewish Day of Constructive Conflict, I'd like to explore a conflicting vision, one that emphasizes not the golden wings, but the faces, the miksha, the single block from which they are pounded. The Gemara in Chagiga asks exactly our question. My kruv, what the heck is this thing called the kruv? I think they're asking here about the, what does the word mean? Amarabia bahu karavya. Translating it into Aramaic. Shechein babavel korin liyanuka ravya. That ke means like, and ravya in Aramaic means child. So it's like a child, says Rabbi Abahu. This thus explaining the second part of the Merriam-Webster's dictionary definition, a beautiful young child with small wings and a round face and body. So that seems to come from this Gemara, that it's a like a small child. Amarli Rav Papa, and then Rav Papa and Abaye have a discussion. Wait a minute, I feel confused. If it's a small child's face, but when Yechezkel had this many-faced creature, which was also called a kruv, there one of the faces was a person, and one of the faces was the kruv. And if both of these are human faces, it wouldn't seem to be, then there wouldn't be four different faces. And the Gemara answers that by suggesting that that one of the faces was a revreve and the other zutre, that there was a that there were two faces. One kruv was the face of a child, and the other was the face of an adult. And Rabbeinu Bechaya explains these kruvim, this adult face and child face, not as representing angels at all, but as representing the people of Israel, the children of Israel, Bnei Yisrael, and Hashem, where Hashem is the adult and Bnei Yisrael is the child. Says Rabbeinu Bechaya, is there any love stronger than that of the father and the son? The love of the father and the son is precisely the kind of unconditional, stomach-pounding love that God has for us. And that is what is being symbolized in the Mishkan. In the center of the Mishkan is a representation of God interacting with us. The physical intimacy of the Kruvim, the miksha achat, that they come from one piece, is symbolized in the extremely close and unmediated love between Hashem and his people. The goal is to show specifically that there are no mediating angels, and precisely the opposite of the Rambam, Yechezkel, and Bereshit. There's total unity between the Jewish people and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, miksha achad. Interestingly, a similar but apparently contradicting Gemara in Yoma paints a slightly different picture. There, Rav Katina says, "B'shah shayu Yisrael olin l'regel, megalgalin lehen et haparochet, umarin lehen et kruvim shayu me'orim ze bazeh, v'omrin lehen, ra'u chibatchen lifnei hamakom, kechibat zachar v'nekeva." At the time that the Jewish people would make aliyah, would make pilgrimage to the temple, they would roll up the parochet, the cover that was blocking the way to the Kodesh Kodeshim, and they would show them the kruvim, and they would show that those kruvim are me'orin ze bazeh, are intertwined, and they would say to them, "Wow, Ra'u chibatchem, look at how beloved you are before the omnipresent. It is like the love of the male and the female. Now, this Gemara is remarkable on a number of levels. First, like Chagiga, Yoma sees Kruvim as representing the loving relationship between Yisrael and Hashem, a united relationship, a loving relationship between the Jewish people and Hashem, and that the Kruvim don't represent angels, but rather represent Hashem and Bnei Yisrael. However, this time, rather than a father and a son, God is a male and Bnei Yisrael is a female. And the love is a romantic love. The use of this word me'orim is not, which I'm translating as intertwined, is not that they were just hugging nor that they were just touching. They are physically intertwined like a male and a female. In the Hefiel binyan, if you understand Hebrew grammar, in another, the same root can be used to mean arouse or excite, sexual excitement. And in fact, the Ramban doesn't shy away from those sexual erotic connotations and actually calls them a deep secret, that this erotic love, says the Ramban, is holy and has a place in the Mishkan, and kal v'chomer, how much the more so between male and female. So the love in the Gemara and Yoma, again, the Kruvim represent love and unity between Bnei Yisrael and Hashem, but the love is a romantic love, not a parent-child love. Now, I don't think it's coincidental, although it is so surprising that the Gemara objects very explicitly to this, we get the impression, or it says, that they would roll up the parochet so the pilgrims could see. This doesn't seem to make sense, as the Gemara points out, because the Mishkan vessels had to be very carefully covered up because, as it says in Bamidbar, anyone who approaches them unauthorized, in other unauthorized conditions, will die. So here, this required distance is the required distance between God and Bnei Yisrael is symbolically twice eliminated, both in the fact that the Kruvim are literally intertwined, hugging one another, and two, that we're lifting up the parochet so that the Jews who make the pilgrimage can actually, which they do, as the Torah says, lirot et pnei Hashem, in order to see the face of God, they actually seem to literally gaze on Kodesh HaKodeshim. So, according to the Gemara, both in Chagiga and Yoma, as well as the Ramban and Rabbeinu Bechaya, what's most essential about the Kruvim are their faces, the way that the Kruvim are turned intimately to one another, and their physical unity, the miksha achat, they are intertwined. They don't symbolize angels at all, quite the opposite. They symbolize the unmediated relationship between God and Bnei Yisrael, both as a parent and a beloved child, and as lovers. The Kodesh HaKodeshim is the shared inner chamber of lovers, not the concealed and terrifying throne room of a transcendent God. This is a totally different vision of the Kruvim than that of the Rambam and that which emerged from Yechezkel and Bereishit. Are the Kruvim meant to symbolize intimate love between Bnei Yisrael and Hashem, or God's mighty, transcendent, inaccessible throne, a God that cannot possibly be contained in the Mishkan? Do the Kruvim represent angels, or do they represent Bnei Yisrael and Hashem? This is certainly a machloket, but both of them reflect a deep truth. Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. These and those are the words of the living truth, living God. Even though they seem to be mutually exclusive truths, both of them reflect a deep truth, neither of which can actually be truly understood and contained when it comes to understanding our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. But both of them are really essential components in understanding what kind of relationship we can have with God. In both of these contradicting truths are actually contained in the liturgy of the Kedusha and the Birkat Kriyat and the blessings of the before the Shema, where both the angels and Bnei Yisrael join together in declaring God's holiness. Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. How holy is God? we say, blessed is he from his praise. Baruch Adonai Mimkamo. He is transcendent and inaccessible on the one hand, but then we also say Malo Kol Haaretz Kavodo. The entire world is filled with God. God is holy. Right, God's holiness is right here with us, not accessible, not inaccessible at all, but right here with us. It seems the Kedusha and the Birkat Kriyat Shema try to hold those, both that intimacy and immanence of Hashem and the transcendence of Hashem in one prayer. And my prayer for all of us is that we should also be blessed to integrate elements in our relationship of God, both of God's transcendence and of God's deep and intimate love for us. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Dr. Hammer-Kassoy. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.